Spoken word.
A taste of Melbourne's diverse poetry scene.
Poets using their voices to entertain, to move, to take you on a journey.
Connecting you to grassroots poetry and performance.
Good morning and welcome to the 3CR Spoken Word Program. I would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land, the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, and I pay my respects to elders past and present. My name is Di Cousins and today I'm talking to the writer, Grant Caldwell, about his new book of haiku, The Soundless Sound. Welcome, Grant.
Thank you, Di.
So this is part two of a conversation we started last month about haiku and the writing of it and some of the underlying principles which can be found or sometimes are not found but which might be found within haiku. Now, you wrote a paper about the Aboriginal perspective on country and the writing of haiku. So I think but there's something about the observation of nature that is a shared component of underlying ideas. Mm. Would you like to talk about that?
Yes. Well, I'm not an expert in First Nations culture at all, but I did some research into my notion of this connection or universality of possibly all cultural bases, and specifically the connection between Basho's reflection of Japanese culture in his haiku and First Nations artists and poets who I came across and know. So one of the artists who I came across whose words and work resonated particularly well with what I was looking for was Brian Martin. Now, Brian Martin said, much of contemporary art practice is divorced from the everyday or real world. For example, postmodern art may at times involve social critiques, but it is primarily built on a negation of any grounded truths. Martin explained more particularly how his and other First Nations artistic practice is contrary to this postmodern approach. Quote, Indigenous cultural productions are founded in the real existence of country and not by an ephemeral relationship to an ideology needing to build over the top of nothingness or in search of an elusive foundation. This is an incredible quote. It's amazing. And Basho likewise observed the need for poets to learn from the real world. I've already quoted him about needing to learn about the pine from the pine. He said that the poet needs to enter into objects they observe in order to understand them. Japanese scholar Koji Kawamoto cites one of Basho's devotees, Hattori Doho, who was a contemporary of Basho's and who recorded Basho's advice to his devotees. And this is Doho explaining Basho's dictum about learning about the pine from the pine. Doho said, when he said learn, the master meant that poets should compose their poems after having entered into their objects to discover and feel their deep and subtle essences. Even should one manage to put the object into words, if there are no feelings emerging naturally from the object itself, the object and the self form a duality, and the feeling will not be sincere. one will only have a fabricated meaning derived from personal intentions. So I hope you can see the connection there between what Basho is saying and Martin's term. What is the term? He uses this term, embodied subjectivity. He says, Martin says, country invokes an embodied subjectivity. In Indigenous terms, one belongs to country, not the reverse.
Yes, so I think that's a really interesting perspective, that it's a sort of the joined up nature of everything, you know, that things are all a part of each other and not there's an independent observer and a separate outside observational world.
Yes.
But, you know, become the pine. So there's some kind of experience of unity with the world, not kind of outside, but both in and outside.
Yes.
Perhaps.
Yes.
So how does haiku work on that idea?
Well, as I've said, what the haiku is doing is, you know, the idea of Zen, you know, I'm using Zen as an example, but not as the principle to follow. You don't have to become a Zen monk to be a poet. You don't even have to know anything about Zen. But Zen just means sitting. It comes from the Chinese Chen, which means sit and contemplate. There's lots of poets and writers have talked about sitting by the window, seeing what happens. This is what you do. So, but when you contemplate something, you start. I read somewhere someone said they went to the desert, and they sat and looked into the bush of the desert, and they didn't see anything. But they still sat there and they watched. And the longer they sat there, the more they started to see. And there were lots going on. There's an abundance of things going on. But when you first look at it, you don't see anything. And I think one of the problems we have is, like me looking at the church car park, it's just a church car park, you know? We see these things every day, but we don't look at them. We see them, but we don't look at them. If you see those things that you look at every day, if you take the time, which none of us have, it seems, if you take the time to look at something for a long period of time, you start to become that thing and you start to see and feel things in it that you didn't have first see or that you might not have seen if you just saw it as you usually do. This is why when we travel, we're traveling so exciting because we see everything for the first time. You know, Matisse said, we must see things like children. We must see things as if for the first time. That's exactly the principle I'm talking about. But you see, here we go again. Matisse is talking about the same thing that Basho is talking about.
And perhaps there's also this reciprocity in nature, that if you take the time to see nature, then nature reveals itself to you. So there's a kind of a communication or perhaps or a conversation between yourself and nature in that sense of the
That's a really interesting observation. I'm sure there's a lot of haiku, and I could look at my own from that perspective and see how I am reflecting how there's a conversation going on between me and whatever I'm observing, whether it's nature or other people, because, as I've said, I don't know if I've said in the recording, you know, people are nature. People are, I think people are trees that can walk around, you know.
It's a lovely idea. Well, let's get to some more poems from your new book, The Soundless Sound.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I'll just read a few.
Yeah, just
that
read
I
a
pick
few.
Out.
Yeah, any you like.
You want to pick a season or a scenery? Let's go to autumn. Autumn's always good because this is a poem that was a favourite of a friend of mine. This is, again, what happens, what delightful thing about, one of the delightful things about writing these kind of poems is that different people choose different poems that resonate with them, which is, it's very special to me when this happens. And this friend of mine said that they like this poem. The sound of a beetle. moving under dead leaves. So do you want me to talk about the poem?
Yeah, I'd like to talk about the poem.
Well, I don't like interpreting my own poem because that takes away other people's interpretation of the poem. That's the problem with doing that.
I know, but at the same time, there may be some listeners who are less experienced at interpretation who just who don't find the second or the third level.
Yeah, but so, then I think they, if I dare say, they need to read the poem like you said before. And the thing with haiku is you can observe the whole poem over and over again. It doesn't take a lot of time. As you read one of Wordsworth's poems or Allen Ginsberg, you know,
it's a longer poem.
It takes a number of minutes to read, and then you go and read it again and you get lost. But that's here, you can get lost in the actual moment of this poem, whatever generated it. But, all right, look, I'll break my rule, but with some resistance, Di.
Thank you, Grant.
I like the fact that there's sound in this poem. I mean, the title of the poem is The Soundless Sound, which comes from a famous cone. Like a question given to devotees of Zen monks in order to enlighten them.
Yeah, it's a focus for meditation.
Yes, that's right. But meditation can mean a lot of different things, but I'm not going to go into that.
Yeah.
Anyway, so there's the sound of the beetle. So we've got sound here, and it's moving under dead leaves. So we've got movement as well. We've got sound, we've got movement, and the dead leaves, which suggests autumn, right? So we've got a seasonal reference, and the dead leaves, you know, autumn is kind of, it's leading towards winter, which is symbolic of death. But death not in the kind of way that a lot of religions see it, but it's a transformation. And the beetle, you know, we know beetles don't live very long anyway. I don't know how long they live, but they probably don't live more than a month. I don't know. But they're so small, a minute to a beetle is like is a month to us.
Yeah.
See what I mean? It's a very relative.
Yeah.
So, and the other thing that I like about this poem, and I'm talking about what I like about it, I'm not necessarily referring to any of the principles I've been talking about. Hopefully there's a reference to them here, but the fact that I observed this beetle, I became the beetle. I am not in the poem, except as the observer. But I'm not. It's not objective and it's not subjective. I am the beetle moving under the dead leaves. But the reason I'm becoming that is because the movement caught my attention because I was taking the time to sit there and look and contemplate. I wasn't meditating in the conventional sense, but I was meditating in the Chan or Zen sense of sitting, observing and contemplating.
Awareness.
Yes, thank you. That's exactly what it is. And so that's what this poem does. Now, I think there's lots of other things going on in this poem, so don't let me reduce it to that single interpretation because, you know, it's too close to me, and this is one of the reasons I'm hesitant.
Sure. Thank you for
do that.
Yeah, I mean, and just the sense of the season, you know, under the dead leaves, as you say, pointing to autumn, which points towards winter, which
the ephemeral nature.
And the ephemeral nature, but it's also a recurrent cycle.
Yeah.
So it's not a full stop when you get to winter.
Because what happens to the dead leaves? They become earth, don't they?
Yes.
And so does the beetle.
So the cycle of nature is there, and I think it's so good to spend the time just thinking through one haiku to see that there are all these other elements in it that
it expands. It's a ripple effect, isn't it?
That's right. So let's just read a few more haiku, and we might not reflect on each of them, but we will just.
Okay.
Yeah, we'll just go.
Let's go to winter.
Okay. So this is the Spoken Word program. My name is Di Cousins and I'm talking to Grant Caldwell about his new book, The Soundless Sound. So Grant, what poems would you like to read?
Well, I can read the whole book, Di, but
in the time available.
Well, it's hard. It's very hard. I read this poem. A lot of these poems come quickly and with a little bit of work, some quite a bit of work and changing around. And I seem to be writing less and less. I'm getting on a bit. I'm trying to acknowledge to myself. And so what I did recently, I went through my notebooks and I found a lot of poems that I had not developed adequately and gone on with, but I'm glad I kept my notebooks. And I found some poems that I could take and reshape and polish and bring up to some kind of satisfactory point for myself and my understanding of what I was doing. And this particular poem is one that I had abandoned a number of times because I couldn't catch it, what I was trying to catch, and I finally got it. And I'm just trying to look here. It might be 575 syllables.
Well, we won't hold that against the poem.
No, it's poor not. Poem. Thankfully, it's not. It could be 555. Anyway, so I'll read it and then I'll try and talk about it. In the old bird bath, raindrops bounce and join the green water. Now, it's a very visual poem. This is spring. Spring. So it's spring, and but it's an old bird bath, you know. And a lot of us have old bird baths, or we know they exist in gardens and whatever. And I'm just thinking aloud here. The old bird bath represents an unchangingness, you know, a continuity, a history. And you could even interpret the term, the Japanese term, as the history of the culture, and not just the never changing. And you know, the most famous poem of Basho's, Old Pond, a frog jumps into the sound of water, which confounds many people. But it's the poem that really brought it, you know, in Japanese. I don't read Japanese, so I can't comment on how it sounds in Japanese. But anyway, here we have in the old bird path, raindrops bounce and join. There's a visual thing. There's a great poem, is it by Shiki? It could be by Jack Kerouac, indeed, about hail bouncing around the inside of a boat. It's a fantastic poem. You can hear the hail. Oops, sorry. You can hear the hail, just like that bang then. It's probably not as that loud as that. And the fact that the raindrops are individual, but then they become one with each other. I like that idea. I can't explain why. It's something along the lines of what you were saying earlier, Di, and in the green water. And the green water, again, in an old bird bath, there's a lot of, what's it called, is it lichen? What's that stuff?
Well,
there's green.
It's kind of mould.
It's not mould. It's more...
Slime.
Slime. I wasn't quite, but you're right, it's slime. But it's also, what's that stuff that grows, that green stuff that grows in when it's very damp? It's beautiful little moss.
Right.
Moss.
Okay.
So there's
but
moss.
But I mean, if the moss...
But it's reflective as well. Right. Because you see, in a garden, you'll have a reflection on the water. So the water's not necessarily green. It could be, it seems to be green, but it could also be greeny.
Right.
Colour. And again, this is... it's just an observation, which I kind of like a lot,
yes.
But I can't explain it much better than.
Yeah. No. Well, that's a special moment.
Yeah.
Looking at
exactly that's a special moment.
That's all it has to
be. I mean, it's all it has to be. You know, look at the Cartier-Bresson photos. You know, the man jumping the puddle, and the shadow. I mean, you can't explain that photo. Why should you? It's just amazing. It just like opens your head up, doesn't
it? Yeah, it's a beautiful thing. This
is the thing, you know, people have small minds and they need to have large minds. And hopefully that's what art does.
I agree. It should open one's heart and one's mind.
Well, heart and mind. Yeah. You know, in Chinese, they mean, I'm not a Chinese expert, but they mean the same thing. Qi is mind and heart.
Yep. I believe the Japanese word is heart, mind as a single word.
Yeah.
Yeah. So let's go to another one of your haiku.
Okay. The dogs in the park don't know they are owned.
That's very...
It's a senru.
It's kind of fun.
And it's funny.
Yeah.
But dogs are hilarious. And I like dogs, of course. Yes. Who doesn't? Well, some cat people don't like dogs. But this is a thing, again, it's something you see every day. And dog owners, you know, they're dog owners. But who's the boss? You know, the dog owner's picking up the poo of the dog. They feed the dog. All the dog has to do is agree to have a lead and a collar.
Yes.
Now, you and I don't want a lead or a collar, but we don't need people...
looking after us that much.
No.
No, no. I'm sure the dog sees the relationship in a more complex manner than just being owned, you know.
I think they see it more simply.
Right.
I've heard that it's observed that dogs think they're... They think that humans are also dogs, but they're just cleverer. They know how to get food and a warm place to stay. And so all we have to do is, you know, enjoy ourselves.
Yeah. So it's just a kind of we are one pack, and the other guys are the kind of the cooks.
Dogs are pack animals, exactly. Yeah, and they love people. There's another dog poem about the dogs at a local football game, Barrack for Everyone. Or something like that.
That's cute.
And that's what I observed. Like everyone else is looking at the football game and I'm walking around and I'm a little bit interested. I used to play the game, blah, blah, blah. But I noticed the dogs, they're all just really happy to be there amongst all these people.
Yeah.
They don't care who wins the football game. No. But the other people do because they're either one side or the other, you see.
Yeah.
So anyway, there are a number of poems in here that are... Well, they make me laugh.
Let's find another one. I remember when somebody pointing out that we might get angry at cockroaches coming inside the house, but cockroaches don't have an idea of inside or outside the house.
No, it's not their fault. Yeah. They're just doing what they do.
Yeah. Anyway, let's get to the next poem.
Hmm. All right. People stop at the corner and look at their phones to see where they are.
Yes, well, that's fairly.
But it's, you see it all the time.
You do.
But you don't see it. You see what, you know.
Yeah.
So this is a poem a friend of mine just this morning said that they jumped out at them. And, you know, you said, I'm not sure if you said it, but about Basho saying, you know, there has to be more than one idea. Well, of course, you know, that's the whole idea. But often, traditionally, there's often a break in the poem where you have one idea or a broken fragment describing a scene or an idea, and then a break and another fragment jumping to somewhere else. That's somehow... culturally or theoretically or notionally connected. And this works along those lines, I think. Families at the beach, hidden rocks in the sea.
I love that one. You know, under the surface, there's so much going
but
on.
But it's also visually accurate.
It is.
You know, but the metaphor,
the double meaning. Or...
What's the metaphor I said before? It's not indirect. The indirect metaphor is pronounced. You know, it's very obvious, isn't it?
Yes.
But that doesn't make it any less powerful. You know, hopefully, for me. So yeah, I like that too. I like that, and you know, we have a sense of the hidden rocks in the sea of families. I think most of us do.
Absolutely.
But also, you know, we know about this in reality, that there are hidden rocks, and there are not just hidden rocks in the sea, there are other things in the sea that are metaphorically hidden rocks, like sharks and
tides and tides rips and things
and rips and holes and etc. So it's a place of relaxation and leisure, and but it also can be very dangerous.
And it may be very beautiful underneath. You know, there may be seahorses or dolphins or beautiful
and families
coral
that
or
we know on the surface. Mm. In many cases, look harmonious and everyone loves each other, but you go inside the house for a while, you'll find the hidden rocks.
You will, yeah. And maybe the sea dragons and things too. Who knows?
Yes, yeah. Oh, totally. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. We've got time for one more.
Okay. So there was a poem I just wrote recently, but I'll go to this poem here, which is an example of breaking a number of the principles, okay? The lift door opens. A human-sized cell phone leans in the corner. So, I mean, you know, it's not literal. I didn't see this. I made it up. So I broke that rule. So you don't have to, you know, you can write a poem out of your imagination. I like to do that every now and then, not just as for people, other people, but for myself. If I have an idea that I think can fit into the notion of a poem, then I'll do it. Who cares?
Yeah. No, that's. I mean, it's a good commentary on modern life, and yes, you know, we worry about AI outside, we should also worry about AI inside.
Well, it could happen.
Yeah.
I mean, this was written. This poem was written three or four years ago, before AI became such a big deal.
Yes.
You know, AI has become a big deal very quickly.
It has.
And I wrote this before.
Yep.
But it's even more pertinent now.
That's right.
Because this could happen.
So let's just hear it again so that...
The lift door opens. A human-sized cell phone leans in the corner. There's a number of lift haikus written around the world, lots of different anthologies. I have a friend of mine who's, you know, we've discussed making a lift anthology, and there's a great poem, and I shouldn't try and quote it because it's just beautiful. It's something like, the lift door opens and closes again. Something like that. It's an American poem, and it's probably better than what I just did it justice. But it's that simplicity of something that we observe all the time, but we don't see it for what it is.
Yes. Well, it's about that crystallization of the moment, finding the changing and the unchanging. There,
if they're any good?
Yeah. Mm. Well, I think that's about all we've got time for.
Yep.
So thank you for coming in, Grant.
My pleasure, Di. I had a lot of fun.
Yes, me too. And so my name is Di Cousins, and I've been talking to Grant Caldwell about his new book, The Soundless Sound. This has been the 3CR Spoken Word Program.